Hello, outdoor explorers. I'm the producer of the show, Eric Bork. Today, we're going to revisit an episode that first played in September of 2015. Charles had some great conversations about Alaska's coastal brown bears. We'll find out what it's like to go visit with bears. We'll learn about some of the biology and habits of brown bears. And you'll hear how you can go see them for yourself. It's a great show, so stick with us.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're here today to talk about bears. Our region of Alaska happens to be the best place in the world for ordinary people to get out in the woods and see lots of gigantic bears. The coastal brown bear grow to enormous size, but while they're gorging on the salmon that makes them so large, they don't pay attention to anything else. Visitors to certain key streams can get very, very close. We'll talk about that experience and the life of the bears. For starters, we'll be talking with a friend and colleague of mine who was lucky enough to go in August to the McNeil River Bear Sanctuary and saw some amazing stuff. Then we'll have two biologists to talk about why we have such large bears, where you can see them, and how it works that we can do this safely. Stay with us. It's going to be fun. So my first guest is Laura Jorgensen, someone I is a friend who I work with, also an amazing athlete. She did a full Ironman in Cozumel last year. And Laura was lucky enough to go to the McNeil River Bear Sanctuary just last month, or just in August, right?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago.
So just set the scene for us. I mean, just for starters, because I've seen pictures, and you don't know, like, how they must be using telescopic lenses. They must, how did they ever get that close? You can see every hair on the bear's back. Well, what's it really like down there?
You really actually do get that close. It's quite surprising. I think my husband and I went with our kind of average cameras, and many of the folks that were around us who got a permit for the same time were photographers who, you know, came there to make their living, and they brought their 2 to 3 foot lenses and all kinds of things. I think that's, they were used to seeing bears so far off. And I would say half the time we were the only ones who could take photos because their lens was too big.
The bears were, and the so bears close, like were the so iPhone close. Photos would work, huh?
Oh, yeah, for sure. iPhone photos would work, except that we were in a lot of rain also. So having something else was a little bit more helpful. But usually I'd say half of our experiences were between 10 and 15 feet away. So it was
amazing.
It sounds
utterly terrifying to be 10 feet away from like a huge brown bear. I mean, they could take you down and eat you with absolutely no effort.
It is surprising. I think, you know, I have had a few other bear encounters previously, and I really was quite nervous or scared. This time, it was really a very different experience. When we arrived at the camp, the staff there and the biologist kind of gave you an overview of what to expect and kind of gave you a mini training so that the more that we behaved in a certain way, the more apt the bears would come closer to us and the more unique experience we would have. And sure enough, as we were, many times we as a group, there's only 10 people allowed out each day, and we were guided by the staff. And sometimes we were asked to, you know, line up in a single file line without any gaps. And other times, depending on maybe the bears that were coming ahead, the biologists were very familiar with who they are, their unique characteristics or personalities.
They're like old friends, right?
Old friends. And that many times we would be asked to kind of kind of merge together as a big blob and kind of move as a big group. Sometimes we were asked to kind of stand as we were viewing the bears. Many times we were asked to sit very low, kind of on the riverbed in itself for the viewing. So
are the bears like totally ignoring you, or are they sort of like paying attention to you, but they just are not freaked out by your presence?
I think a combination of both, really. I think many times, because we came in August, we were seeing a lot of family groups, so sow and cubs, and many times the cubs are very curious. So they're coming up and standing up above the weeds or the grass, and they're looking right at you, and because they're kind of trying to figure out what are you or what's going on here. And the mother would come by and keep on moving as though we weren't even there. So they're, you know, kind of a combination of both. But
so you must be so close that you can really hear and smell and just have.
Oh.
Tell me about the experience of being that close to one of these. I mean, they could get up to like a ton.
Oh, yeah. There was one time that we were kind of just heading out in the morning, and down on the bluff, we saw a sow and her cub, two cubs that were kind of playing, and we were watching for a while, and we're on a little path. Every day when you leave the camp, we go out to explore certain areas, and all of a sudden, the sow and the cubs were kind of coming up towards the camp, and we thought, oh, well, this is going to be kind of interesting, and then all of a sudden, they're on the path that we are actually standing on, and they're coming at us. And the guide said, well, I think we should just back up about 10 feet. So we all kind of backed up 10 feet. They came directly in front of us. They stopped right there. The two cubs kind of came a little closer. They got off the trail into the kind of grassy weeds where we were and just kind of playing with each other and looking around.
Oh, my gosh. So how far away are they at that point?
At that point, probably about 8 feet.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, each time when we head out from camp or anywhere outside of going to the outhouse, you're with your guide, and the guide does have a gun. The guides and staff there have told us that in their whole life and the life of the program, they've never actually even pulled their gun. You know, so, but it does give you a sense of, well, there's something safe if needed.
You're covered, right?
Yeah.
So when you're that close, 8 feet away from a playing bear cub, it's like you're almost in the same room with them.
Oh, yeah. There was a couple times where the cubs were playing and, you know, decided they were hungry. And mom said, not now. And they made a noise like I have never heard. The two of them sounded, you know, like a two-year-old having a tantrum because they were hungry now. And I was hoping, oh, maybe next time I'll catch that on video. And one time I was filming, and the two cubs were really hungry, and mom said, not now. And really, I was surprised without an external mic, still the sound.
Oh, you got it.
Yeah, the sound of the two of these cubs just whining and begging and pleading.
Go to alaskapublic.org, and you'll find today's show about bear viewing. My guest right now is Laura Jorgensen, who just came back from the McNeil River Bear Sanctuary, which is a state of Alaska program, how fortunate you are to have gotten to do that. How did you get that opportunity?
Well, it's an interesting process. I think it was last year I went to River of Bears, the film that was the first film that was ever produced for a planetarium. So it was aired at UAA, and they talked about this lottery that you could enter to go out to McNeil River. And so it was my son's senior year, and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to do something special before he heads off to college? And I said, oh, let's sign up for that lottery for McNeil River. You do have to read the details the fine details, because I guess the lotteries that I'm used to, you put in for a name or one or two people, and whoever gets drawn, then they get to decide who goes. Well, that's not really how it works. So I had put in for both my husband and I. It said maximum three per party. So I thought, oh, well, if either one of our names get drawn, the three of us, including my son, could go. And that is not the case. Oh. So only the names that are submitted in on that lottery application are the only people that are permitted to go. Mm. And each year, McNeil River has 180 individuals that are awarded this lottery. And the way I understand it is usually most the summer from June through end of August are divided up into kind of 5-day blocks. And when you complete your lottery application, you pick three blocks that are going to be a good time for you. Mm-hmm. And then when they do the lottery, I believe 66% of the people selected for lottery, it is a statute in state law that they do have to be Alaskans, and the remaining portion is open up worldwide. And my understanding, they have people from all different countries every year.
Probably a really competitive lottery.
Yeah. And I think June, particularly July, is a peak time where you have maybe less chance when you put in for mm-hmm. the lottery. We happen to have one of our dates in August, which you have a little bit higher chance, but the experience is very different from what I understood from the guides. Most of the pictures you see on the website are people looking at McNeil Falls, and there being 20, 25 bears around. Mm-hmm. That is true for July and some of August when the salmon are running up Mitfick Creek. But in August, this is really a very different time. So the salmon have thinned out significantly, and it's more time for kind of that family experience.
This is still an incredible experience. So, yeah.
But it's an intimate experience in August, and right. I think I would choose that
great.
If I had a chance.
So it's down on the west side of Cook Inlet, pretty mm-hmm. far down. So you fly out of Homer?
Yes.
And then is it a tent camping or the cabins?
Yeah, no, you bring all of your own gear, your own food. They have a cook shack, so to speak, so that you can actually, they have kind of pots and pans and burners and some dry area where you can be eating because it could rain the whole time you're there.
Which it did, it sounds
which
like.
Pretty much so, except the day we left, we did get to see we were surrounded by beautiful mountains.
But you weren't complaining too much.
Oh, no. Yeah. Despite leaving camp every day at 10:30 and coming back at 8 o'clock at night,
all day,
I think looking back, I barely remember rain. It was just such an amazing experience.
You were there for 5 whole days.
Yes.
Wow. So, in terms of any advice that you would give people for how to do it differently, or is it perfect?
The sanctuary does provide a great checklist of what to bring with you. You really do want to look at all of that. When you are flying either from Homer or King Salmon, there are weight restrictions. So you do want to be aware of that. You have to, as soon as you are notified that you're one of the winners, you're going to want to book a flight right away. These are not commercial flights. So they're, you know, these planes most often travel just for McNeil River and various other outings. And so, you know, there's 2 to 3 seats on a given time period. Uh-huh. And so making that reservation early and thinking about extra things that you wouldn't normally think about for rain. So not only keeping yourself dry, but thinking about your equipment and other things.
It's kind of an outdoor expedition for
major.
For 5 days.
So I used big Ziploc bags and covered my camera and poked the lens out and, you know, put a rubber band around it.
Cooking your own food?
Yes.
And basically, it's like an outdoor camping experience. They're not holding you by the hand.
Yeah exactly.
So, was there downtime, or were you basically around bears the whole time?
Well, I would say there was always a little downtime in between. In August, you're actually moving around to various areas. Like in July, you may sit at the falls for half the day or the whole day. Here, in a given day, we'd probably move to maybe 6 different locations, and sometimes we would. At the end of the day, I happened to have my little Garmin on, and we would have hiked 7 to 8 miles.
Oh, wow.
Kind of moving around. And as we'd move to one area, we might see, you know, a bear coming, or we would actually see them and go place ourselves in a targeted area where they are likely to come next. So they would be coming downriver or whatever it might be. And the guides were, you know, right on with what to expect. And I bet you know, this is what's going to happen. And they really shared a lot of information with the visitors there about each bear and some of their behavior, so that even when we left, you know, I could quickly know, well, that's Braveheart over there, and that's Lax and her 2 cubs, and that's Mouse, and, you know, the different bears just by either certain visual characteristics or things about their behavior.
It seems like you would come back with like a 10 million photos and,
yeah.
probably more than you could ever show to anybody,
yes.
right? And And at some point you might want to just say, hey, stop taking pictures, because you'd have so many opportunities for amazing pictures.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, folks that many people that we were around came there, professionals, they came there for that. We came for the experience. So there are many times I wasn't taking pictures, you know. Because you do want to see it, not just through a little peephole, but really get to see everything around. And I think that's somewhere finding a balance would be good.
Yeah. Is this something that you've done before? I mean, you're not like a biologist, right? This is just something that anybody could do, essentially.
Yeah.
Anybody's reasonably fit and knows how to camp and cook their own food.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, have some good odds. I saw a photographer at the fair who had some bear pictures out, and, you know, I had mentioned, hey, we just came from McNeil River, and I said, we just put in this year for the first time for the lottery. He said, you got it the first time? I said, kind of like, well, doesn't everybody? And I guess it took him 8 years to get in for the bear lottery. So
takes a lot of luck.
Yeah.
So if you don't get lucky, then you have to think about going to down to Kodiak or going out to Brooks Camp in Katmai National Park. And we're going to be talking a lot more about that in the second part of the show. But first, I want to thank Laura Jorgensen for coming in and sharing about her amazing experience at the McNeil River Bear Sanctuary. And we're putting her photos on the website so you can see some of these pictures, which are truly amazing. AlaskaPublic.org. Just click on today's show on bear viewing. Thanks so much for being with us, Laura.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
We're going to take a quick break and talk about the most popular way to see coastal brown bears, by BearCam. Last year, 16 million viewers directed their browsers to the explore.org bear cams at Katmai National Park and Preserve. That's more viewers than The Bachelor, American Idol, or Dancing with the Stars. The bear cam went live for its fourth summer this year. Reporter Hannah Colton filed this report from Dillingham.
In the days before the cams went live this season, the comments section on the website felt like the long bus ride to summer camp. Returners were all there, catching up with old friends, swapping stories from last year, getting excited and impatient. They were ready to see some bears.
I can't wait. I'm itching to see the bears again.
That's 68-year-old artist and writer Dickie Neely.
I live in Corpus Christi, Texas.
I found Neely because he'd posted some of his art on the website, a drawing of a big goofy bear with its nose up against a camera. Neely first found his way to explore.org last year when he was looking for surfing videos.
And I'm an old surfer, and I'm disabled now, and I can't surf anymore, so I'm home a lot. So I was looking around at live surfing cams, and I just happened to notice the bear cats. So I clicked on it, and first thing I saw, it was a bear towing a cub. A cub was riding on its back out in the water. And that little cub, when it jumped off her back, that little cub was just bouncing around and so full of life, and I thought that little bear is really happy to be alive and to be a little bear right now. It's just so obvious. And it made such an impression on me.
How often and for how long would you say you watch the cams while they're live during the summer?
Well, every day and sometimes for hours.
I went to an expert to find out how all these remote viewers are affecting day-to-day life at Brooks Camp.
My name is Roy Wood, and I'm the Chief of Interpretation for Katmai National Park and Preserve.
Wood is known affectionately by the bear cam community as Ranger Roy. He says these viewers are from nearly every country on the planet.
With just a few exceptions, I think like Yemen had no visitors, Syria had no visitors, which that isn't really surprising. But last year, the major surprise was that India moved way, way up the list. India is now the third largest viewer of the bear cams, and Pakistan is, one, two, three, four, the fifth largest viewer. And that was really surprising to us because we don't see very many people from India or Pakistan that visit the park in person.
Nor does he see many visitors from the Vatican City. But he says 45 people are watching from there, too.
My sincere hope is that every now and then the Pope is watching the bear cams along with the rest of the world.
In the pre-cam days, Wood says he would give his presentations out on the platforms in Brooks Camp, talking with a handful of people at a time. Now, he says, a single live-streamed talk might reach up to 15,000 people.
The first time we saw those numbers just ticking up like that, it kind of, you know, it's kind of scary because you're used to dealing with, you know, 15, 20, maybe 50 people in front of you at any one time, and to see that, you know, now there's 15,000 people around the world watching you. I know it just brings a different feel to it.
So what is it about these bear cams that is so universally appealing?
Well, one thing that was, I guess, somewhat surprising was how readily people would grasp the idea that bears are individuals.
There might be 50 to 70 bears each season at Brooks Camp. That's so many, Wood says. It can be hard for people on the ground to tell one bear from another.
But the bear cam people, some of them are just amazing at their bear identification and their observational skills. I mean, they're picking up on things that, you know, a trained observer at Brooks Camp doesn't always pick up on.
Wood says it's exciting to have all these extra sets of eyes on the bears. It means when something unusual or interesting happens, they're less likely to miss it.
So that's been really cool that they've been jumping in as citizen scientists and really helping us, you know, learn more and document more about the bears here.
To Wood, this is a great success of the Bear Cam project.
You know, there aren't many people that are moved to action from just watching television. but the CAMs are moving people to action, and we're all very proud of that.
Back in Corpus Christi, Dickie Neely says spending so much time watching the CAMs has changed the way he views bears.
I don't see how you could watch those bears for any length of time and then still regard them as the dangerous, killer, ferocious wild animals eager to rip humans apart on sight, you know, like a lot of people look at them. But you see, their normal behavior is not vicious or anything like that.
According to Ranger Roy, the bear cams are here to stay. And I think as long as Katmai has bears, there will be people all over the world watching and rooting for them. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 8 on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
This is one of our favorite outdoor explorers and has been edited to be replayed here today.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about bears today, particularly the great big bears that live along the South Central Coast where we live and that can be viewed and are so spectacular and more are drawing people from around the world to see them. And I have two expert guests in the studio. I'm excited about the conversation we're going to have about, you know, why are the bears here? Why are they so big? And all other science facts about bears. Grant Hildebrand is a regional wildlife biologist for the National Park Service. Thanks for being with us, Grant.
Yeah, good morning.
And Sean Forley is a wildlife physiologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thanks for being with us, Sean.
Howdy.
So, Sean, let's do the basic primer. Why are brown bear so big on the coast and interior not so big? And it's the same animal as a grizzly bear. It's no difference. We just have a different name for it for
Correct.
Some reason, right?
Right, yeah. Think of the continuum between a Chihuahua and a Great Dane.
Right.
They're both dogs. They're both part of the same species, but they're certainly very different in size. And in the bear world, we have something that goes on that's called sexual selection, especially for males, in which the larger males are the ones that tend to have more ability to pass on their genes. And so if a bear is being, like on the Katmai Coast, we've got some pretty high food densities. The ability to be selected for larger and larger sizes continues as an evolutionary pressure. And so that's one of the hypotheses that's out there for why some of these coastal bears can get so large compared to interior bears that you might find, say, in Denali or the Neltje Basin, where the food resources are a lot more scarce and the bears generally don't get to be the same size.
So if you looked at the genes of a Denali bear and the genes of a Kodiak bear or of a Katmai bear, they're not going to look exactly the same because there's been some selection because of this habitat that they're in.
Well, I wouldn't go so far to say
okay. That's
the case.
That's a hypothesis.
It's a worthy hypothesis, yes. But the phenotypic expression, that is the size that they can achieve, is greater out on the coast.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So the food resource, and Grant, let's talk about like what the habitat is out there that makes it so good. I mean, there's lots of salmon, obviously, but the salmon are not there year-round. That's not the only thing they're eating, right?
No, it's certainly not. And I think, you know, when we think about the nutrition of bears, we think about their economics, but the difference is rather than money, calories are their currency. And so it's an incredibly rich environment, and salmon are certainly important coming in the fall. They're coming in at an important time when they're starting to put on fat in particular, some protein for hibernation and cub production. But what's also really apparent on the coast too, in terms of the vegetation that greens up early in the spring, it's highly available and it's a high quality. Clams are available, flounder's available, lots of different things in the feed
flounder.
On.
So they actually catch, how do they do that? They just splash around in the intertidal?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So some of Sean's past work, they were observing bears feeding on flounder, and we have video collars out on bears right now. We're actually getting the bears view of them catching flounder, and they not really sure if they're kind of feeling for it because there's a certain amount of depth and they're clearly going underwater and they're coming up with fish. But one bear in particular we saw catch 10 flounder in a row. About every 15 minutes they would catch and consume a flounder and go right back fishing again. So it's one of the many things that are there for them to feed on. And a couple things that are important. One is there's a low cost of acquisition. It's not an expensive food to go get, but it's also it's a low risk food to go get also. There's other places where they rely on other types of foods in the spring, you know, in particular ungulates. But you spend more energy getting those, but there's also a higher risk in acquiring them.
So when you talk about ungulates, they'd be like moose calves and caribou
calves, correct.
And this kind of thing.
So
I'm very curious to hear about the video collars, but I'm going to hold off a little bit because I want to, you know, to go into a discussion about all your study techniques. But let's talk for a minute about just the physiology of these animals and how big they are and how strong they are. I mean, until you really see one, I guess you can see them in the zoo, but it's hard to imagine an animal that's as big as like a full-grown coastal brown bear. I mean, Sean, how big do they get?
Oh, I think the heaviest that probably Grant and I have weighed might have been on the Kenai, and it was about 1,400 to 1,500 pounds. When we were doing our work down on the coast with Karen Rode, who's a USGS researcher now, she was a grad student at the time, and I think she and I got one bear that gained 400 pounds over a couple of months.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. How can that be possible?
Well, it's pretty interesting. Some really great work coming out of Washington State University has shown that, you know, in the fall, the bears are trying to put on mass, usually fat, in order to make it through the winter. And per unit of energy going in, the most efficient way for them to put on that mass is a combination of carbohydrates and lipids and proteins. So they don't necessarily specialize just on fish completely, but they select throughout the environment for their diet. And that may be part of what like Grant is picking up on, is that the bears, instead of saying, I'm just going to eat fish completely, they actually have more of a mixed diet because it's much more efficient in terms of a caloric increase.
Well, how much food does a 1,400-pound bear that's putting on like 400 pounds in a matter of, I mean, how much food is that animal eating? I mean, calories, it must just be off the charts.
They are. The number escapes me. I don't know, Grant, you got one?
Technically, it's a lot.
Yeah, twice as many as half.
Yeah, but you know, we're talking, you know, tens of fish a day for sure
in
certain areas. So,
And they are obviously really well adapted to gather lots of different kinds of food just because they've got huge claws. Is their eyesight good, or how do they... How do they catch fast-moving fish in the water? I mean, obviously human beings can't do that.
You know, it seems in general people believe that bears' eyesight is probably about as good as ours, maybe a little bit better. It's just that they have other senses that are just so so acute that we tend to focus on those. You know, their sense of smell is legendary for a reason, but I think their eyesight's actually pretty good.
Not that bad. And they've got plenty of practice.
They do, yeah.
So what's the seasonal sort of round for one of these coastal bears? When do they finally go into hibernation, and how long do they hibernate?
Yeah, I think what we've typically seen, it's fairly consistent, I think, probably across our study areas. We tend to go out and start looking for bears in our collaring efforts late April, early May. So they tend to be coming out about that time. Typically, we'll see females with new cubs staying either at or in their den longer. In terms of den entry, typically mid to late October is what we'll commonly see.
Wow. Yeah. So they're like half of the year they're asleep.
They are. Yeah, and so it goes back to, you know, something Sean was touching on, is just the amount of weight that they gain. You know, once it's an adult bear, it's really not changing size dramatically year to year. It's changing size within the year. So everything they gain, they also tend to lose that each year. So it's you know, it's a real physiological marvel, something that's certainly interesting and fairly unique.
Yeah, so they really have to be on. I mean, they're in a rush. They got to really eat a lot of food fast because they're eating a year's worth of food in 6 months. Yeah. So where do they find dens that are, I mean, you don't like stumble across bear dens, at least I've never heard of that. I think that I knew somebody who knew the location of a bear den in Homer at one time, but that was really unusual. And yet an animal this size must need a really large den. What kind of locations do they use?
I like to say that the brown bears den wherever they want.
Right.
I had one here that I could see from my office window on Raspberry Road.
Oh, really?
Yeah, an adult brown bear. So they do choose anything. A lot of the literature that's out there indicates a lot of bear denning occurring above tree line, and a lot of it does occur above tree line, but there's an inherent bias in that those are the dens that you can see in the spring. When we work down like on the Kenai, where there's a real evident tree line, it's much harder to pick out bear dens that are in the trees, even when the leaves are gone. Because that time of the year, when you're out there looking for the bears, everything's brown and white, splotchy. Whereas if you're above tree line, it's all white.
Right.
And you can pick them up. So, you know, we've been in bear dens, in fact, Grant and I on the Kenai, that were maybe 50 feet above sea level, big adult males. So,
do they dig the den, or is there a pre-existing cave there? How does that work?
They'll dig dens, they'll use caves. We had actually black bear den just off the Seward Highway a couple years ago with five different bears in it, and it was only about 30 yards off the road, the main road. Huh. In a rock pile.
Does it make you slightly nervous to crawl into a bear den?
He always sent me. That's not true.
I don't crawl into brown bear dens.
No.
Our brown bears here, I don't think would allow that to happen. It's happened in parts of Sweden. People have done some research that way. Uh-huh. The black bear dens we crawl into pretty routinely if you need to. Mm.
Even that would bother me, but go ahead.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting with bears in general, but with denning too, is you can definitely find papers that will talk about, you know, slope and aspect, you know, what direction, what typical elevation. But I think the longer I've been doing this, the less interested I think I am in what the average animal is doing, and I'm more interested in what individual animals are doing, how much variation there is. This past winter in Gates of the Arctic, we had about maybe 28 or 30 collars out, but we left they were GPS collars getting satellite locations, and typically we'll turn them off to rest the battery so we don't get locations during the winter. These we left on, and what we found was about half of our bears were actually leaving the den in January and February, and not just sticking their head out, but going for day-long forays repeatedly. Yeah. And we don't really know why we're doing that. You know, you introduced us as experts, and being an expert means you know how much you don't know. We haven't figured that one out yet, and we're really curious if it was related to low snowfall or related temperature and what will happen this next year if we get more snow. But that was something, at least for me, that was surprising. So even denning itself, both den selection, but what they're doing, I don't think we fully have worked out. And partly because we just haven't looked before.
Yeah. This is something that I've heard from other wildlife biologists, is that technology is sort of rewriting the textbooks in a lot of ways. I was talking to Craig Macken, who studies whales, and he's seen these satellite tags that they put on whales. They found out that orcas were like doing all kinds of stuff that they had never imagined they were doing just because they'd never had a way to look at them before. Is that the technology you mentioned, a way in which it's changed? Is your view of brown bear changing in any other facets because of the new ways of studying them?
I would argue that some of the newer genetic techniques that are coming along lines are really opening up a lot of windows into the physiology of the bear, and some basic questions about how you can be in a den fairly immobile for so long and not develop bed sores and muscle atrophy and bone loss. Because for us, for humans, if you were to lay and have to be bedridden for a while, there's some major physiological complications.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bears don't suffer from that. And so some of the newer techniques where we can look at gene expression or taking a look at anabolic growth of the bones and development that can occur in the bears, how they regulate that, and it's all brand new stuff.
Interesting. I could see that would have some medical applications potentially.
I think so. And people have worked on bear physiology in hibernation for a long time with the big mantra that we're going to figure out something and then send people to Mars using it. But in truth, I think it's going to be a lot more down-to-earth applications that are really opening our eyes into some of these abilities the bears have.
We'll just mix the genes of the astronauts and the bears, and we'll just end up with very grumpy, hairy astronauts.
Bears aren't grumpy. They are hairy, but they're not grumpy.
I'm for you to stop there. So Grant, you were mentioning video collars. What is that, and how does that work?
Yeah, so I'll kind of build off what we're just talking about now and then add the video collar piece in. Stepping back just to the technology of GPS collars and getting those locations, I think that really was, you know, a game changer for us. And we've been doing that for probably 15 years, give or take. And I guess the analogy is, before that, we would put out a radio collar and we would go fly out whenever we could and see where that bear was, and we'd put a mark, you know, put a dot on a map. But it's the equivalent of what are you doing every Tuesday at noon when the weather's good? Mm-hmm. And how reflective of, you know, is that of what's really important to you or how you make a living or what your life is like? And all of a sudden now we're getting locations every 15, 30 minutes. So we just get a much more refined look at where they're spending time. But the things that we're able to add on top of that, you know, in addition to the genetic work, you know, that Sean's talking about, is we're using stable isotopes, which are just dietary tracers. In essence, you are what you eat, and there's certain signatures in certain foods. So we get an idea of not only where are they spending time, but what are they consuming.
Mm-hmm.
But then coupling that with changes in body weight and fat content and protein, now we're looking at where are you spending time, what are you eating, but what does that mean for you? So in conjunction with survival and cub production, those type of things, we're kind of getting at some of the same questions. We're just getting a more refined approach by blending these together. What's really nice with the video collars is there's a lot of educational implications. We learn a lot, but it also lets us take some of that information we're getting, say, from blood samples where we're trying to get an idea of, you know, what foods are they consuming, But that lacks some refinement. We may know they're eating vegetation. We don't know what kind of vegetation. Mm-hmm. With these video collars, we can actually see, oh, it's eating goose tongue, or oh, it's eating wild celery, or it's consuming sedges.
So it's sort of like the bear's wearing a GoPro.
Yeah, in essence, they wear them just below their chin. Huh. And the reason we started using them, you know, frankly, was because Sean and some of the folks he was working with had deployed them at Anchorage, and you know, it's just phenomenal information you get that way. And so they're starting to be used more and more in the wildlife field. But again, it goes back to, I don't think the questions have changed. Mm-hmm. I think our ability to try and get more refined answers has improved. And that goes back to why, like I said, I think less concerned about what the average bear is doing. And we're learning more and more about kind of what individual bears are doing.
And finding out that there's this huge variability in span of their behavior.
Right. There is, and there's two different ways that happens. One is, we can talk about it a bit if you want, but it's geographically based on the foods mm-hmm. that are available. But the other thing that's really fascinating is, with female bears in particular, the same bear is going to be, in essence, a different animal based on if she has cubs of the year, or she has yearlings, or she's alone. She's going to make a living in different ways. And so there's just so much variation mm-hmm. in how they interact with their environment, and how they interact with other bears.
Amazing.
Yeah, the video collars really are, I think, going to be the biggest game changer. Part of the problem with them is extracting the data from them, because if you think about it, you've got
to go catch the bear again.
No, not so. That's part of it. Although that's going to change too with the downloadable stuff. The biggest issue is you're faced with X number of hours of video.
Somebody has to sit there.
You have to observe it. No, you're not watching it. You're observing it and trying to extract data from that. Because unlike an animal behaviorist who's watching a bear, observing a bear, and recording what it's doing, you're riding along with the bear trying to figure out what it's doing and not just what it's eating. And so one thing we've found from our early bear video work is that we get GPS points, say, every 10 minutes, and there's different statistical algorithms you can apply that'll match up that location and the habitat types that are there to across the broad spectrum of all the points you collect on the bear, so you can come up with a picture of what seems to be important to it. And what we found is that between those 10-minute windows, we have video that's being taken about every 2 minutes, and we see a very different picture of what's important, mm-hmm. very different picture in terms of habitat. So that really is going to change completely when we go through a lot of these calculations in terms of identifying important habitat and what component of the habitats are critical to the bears. And
sounds like a really interesting and challenging time as you're flooded with sort of new data, new kinds of data, figuring out how to handle it.
Well, that's the best thing about science, is we take something pretty simple and make it really complicated.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about coastal brown bears today. These animals that we can go out and watch. I mean, we're incredibly fortunate to live in this part of the world where they're really close at hand, and we can have a bear viewing experience that is just really extraordinary. It's something like you might get if you went to the Serengeti to watch lions, but it's right in our backyard. And I've got two expert guests with me right now. Grant Hildebrand is regional wildlife biologist for the National Park Service, and Sean Farley is a wildlife physiologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So I wanted to get into the sort of the bear viewing and maybe take it from a scientific point of view. Why do the bears tolerate this? Do we think that these bear viewing sites affect the bears? I mean, do they learn to behave differently? I mean, is it a learned behavior? If I drop down into a stream where they'd never been viewed and try to do what they do at Katmai or McNeil, would I end up getting eaten? What do you guys think?
Well, it's a good question. And Dr. Karen Rode works at USGS, and Grant will be like her boss, I think, pretty quick.
I'll be working with her.
Okay. She did an outstanding PhD study out on the Katmai Coast where we asked that very question. And in fact, the experimental design was set up where she and her crew were out for a season observing bears and recording behaviors and the fishing rates, what they were eating, all the general natural history points you could imagine. And then the next year, we brought in what we called pseudo bear viewers. We mimicked a bear viewing program over the entire course of the summer, where we had 5 to 10 people flown out, stay in camp for 3 or 4 days, and trek out each day to where the bears were. Karen and her crew would continue to record those same behavioral observations on the bears to see how the bears were changing, if they were, any of their behaviors in response to the presence of the people. And what she found is that, you know, the females with cubs do tend to use people somewhat as shields from males, that adult males are less likely to tolerate people being around as much as females, although the males are balancing that according to the fact of the females may be an estrus, and therefore there's a strong drive to remain with them. And that when the food densities start to change, the males will assess that density to the point where there was a break-off based on their size that they couldn't really make a living. They would go someplace else.
So do there seem to be a or do we know if bears actually learn their way around these bear viewing areas?
Oh, I'm sure they do. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
They're intelligent animals, aren't they?
They're very smart. Yeah. Yeah, there's no question about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the places where I've spent a fair bit of time is Brooks Camp. Mm-hmm. And I know that you'll talk about that more probably later in the show. But that's a place where you have a lot of fly-in traffic, a lot of viewers, and, you know, really looking at bears, mostly foraging on salmon. And there's the bears absolutely have kind of figured out, for lack of a better word, kind of the rules of the road there, you know, where they can move, when they can move there, and the folks that kind of manage the bears out there, and truthfully, they're managing people far more than bears, but you kind of develop this, there's a form of communication that goes on, but one thing that's definitely interesting there is at certain times of year, in particular in the spring, when some of the young females are in estrus, but aren't really receptive yet to breeding, they will definitely come and spend time in camp, and that, you know, that creates some challenges. Mostly what we try and do is either prevent them from getting in camp or to have them pass through, because once they come through, the males are coming right there with them.
They're looking for shelter. They're looking for some protection, essentially.
They are. And for the most part, the males just do not care. They have a one-track mind at that point in time. The other, I think, thing...
All species are the same.
Yeah. Well, boys are dumb across the board.
Yeah.
But, one thing that's been really striking is we've been doing some collaring on the Katmai Coast this year, and I don't know, probably between the two of us, Sean and I, probably, I don't know if we're at 2,000 bears. We got a lot of bears under our belt at this point. What struck me there is we do the capture using a helicopter coming in, and the bears don't even run from the helicopter until we get right on them. They are so used to aircraft. It's striking. And even on the second capture, they're just not moving. So there is some habituation that occurs. I think through time, they just come to view the presence of people. And the presence of those aircraft as a neutral presence, not mm-hmm. positive, not negative. But that's only going to hold true as long as the human behavior is appropriate and we're not creating attractions, we're not leaving food. And so in all those places, you try and have best practices, explicit rules to maintain, you know, that relationship, if you will. You know, that said, there's definitely times when bear viewers are in places that bears want to be and may preclude bears from getting to those areas. Someplace, you know, like the Katmai Coast, it's so nutrient-rich, it's hard to say that there's an adverse effect from a survival standpoint or a productivity standpoint, but there still may be some disruption of what the bears would be doing naturally if the people weren't there.
Mm-hmm. Huge spread out area. You know, there was a bear viewing outfit. I knew a couple who was doing it, and they closed down their business because they felt like there was too much, too many flights, too much sort of invasion of the bear space, and that some flight services were not being respectful enough of the animals. And I wonder if, from your point of view, from their scientific point of view, if you feel there is a negative impact from bear viewing on the animals writ large, or if it's really not that big a deal.
Well, I know we're discussing the Katmai Coast, but in the context of people and bears interacting tightly together, we did some work here in the Anchorage Bowl several years ago that a lot of people still are very reluctant to accept. But the point was that we have quite a few brown bears that use Bicentennial Park and any of our salmon streams. We picked up upwards of about 35 different brown bears in a single summer coming through town. And one of the reasons it's been so hard for people to accept that is because people don't see them.
Right.
You know, again, it comes back to eyesight. If we don't see something, it doesn't exist. I mean, the bear that's 20 meters off the side of that trail can hear you, can smell you from a long way off, and so you definitely exist to it.
Yeah, so if ever somebody says, well, we did our hike and we didn't see any wildlife, and you can say, well, they saw you, right?
So the reason the bears are there isn't because, and this is true for the Katmai Coast, because of the people. It's there for the food.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, even in the tight confines of the largest city in the state, we can have a lot of brown bears and black bears coming in, finding a way to make a living, and then going back out into the hills.
And they're doing okay number-wise.
Well, as far as we know, we haven't done a population census, but they, as far as I know, we still get X number hit by cars and whatnot. So out on the coast, you know, the bear densities or food densities rule what the bears are going to have to do and where they can go. And so you can have an effect, I'm sure, that if you go to the only spot where the bears are able of actually catching fish and really push them hard, you're going to have an effect. But by and large, it's pretty rare.
Yeah. Something I think everybody knows about the Timothy Treadwell situation, who's the guy who lived out on the Alaska Peninsula and sort of hung around with bears and did stuff that no normal person would do, end up getting eaten by a bear along with his girlfriend. And there was that Grizzly Man, that movie made by Werner Herzog about it. And I think, and I don't know, maybe this is just my impression, but I think people get a little bit of the thought from looking at stuff like Brooks Camp at Katmai and McNeil that, well, brown bear that are feeding on salmon are safe, right? And I'm curious as to how you guys perceive the hazard level of these coastal brown bear to sort of like an interior grizzly bear that might be a little hungrier, or if there is a continuum of how hazardous they are to people, or if better to say just all bears are pretty hazardous. Who wants to take that politically loaded question?
I guess I can start, yeah. And, you know, and Sean can help me out. You know, we you know, relative to what happened with, you know, with Tim Treadwell, we both had, you know, friends and colleagues that were first responders on that. And so, you know, that one's pretty, I think, pretty close to us. It's, you know, when you watch some of the things that he did through time, both, you know, his footage, what was in the film, I mean, the thing that was striking was frankly how tolerant bears are, mm-hmm. in general. And so it's this fine line where you want to treat all bears with respect, but also, you know, one of the things I do is I teach bear safety, both the Park Service staff and other folks. What I don't want to do is create any level of fear that discourages people from going out and enjoying and recreating here. It's beautiful. Seeing bears is a wonderful experience, and so you don't mm-hmm. want to you don't want to preclude that. But there's you know, a handful of precautions that are incredibly important. We all know those. Probably the most fundamental one is just don't surprise bears, and that's true whether you're on the Katmai Coast or you're in Gates of the Arctic or any place else. And you know, so that's certainly one of the big ones. But I think, you know, in general, you have to treat them with respect wherever you are.
Yeah. So I agree that I think people do get scared out of the woods by bear. And people spend a lot more time talking about bear hazard than other hazards, which are probably a lot more dangerous. But then you do have to have a certain level of knowledge.
Yeah.
Predaceous attacks are pretty rare from bears. They can happen. But more often than not, as Grant said, it's you startle the bear, or you're doing something that causes the bear to think it's in danger, or maybe its cubs are, and it's just going to defend itself real quickly and then move on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we just had a recent mauling down on the Kenai, and the fellow that was mauled was hiking where he's been hiking for many years, and it was known in the neighborhood that there were a lot of bears around because of the salmon and stuff. And we don't know the circumstances of this particular incident, but sometimes fate can happen. It's just what happens. But by and large, you know, I mean, people shouldn't be chased out of the woods by the thought that bears are there.
So let's talk about some of the best places and times to go. I mean, there's different seasons when you want to go to Brooks Camp, which is out and flying out to King Salmon and then into Katmai National Park. Then there's the east coast of Katmai, which is on the Alaska Peninsula, then Kodiak Island itself, and then McNeil, where you have to obviously win the lottery. Am I kind of covering the sort of the places where visitors go to look at bears? Is that's pretty much the universe of it.
Yeah, there's also, you know, Packin and Ann Creek, you know, in southeast. But maybe just one thing I'll throw out is I don't want to discourage anyone for going on one of those trips of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. But if you just spend enough time in the woods here, sooner or later you're going to see bears. You're going to see some great things. And so those are phenomenal things to go do. Yeah. But you don't have to necessarily hop on a plane or spend a ton of money to get out and enjoy that either. So
timing is very important for going to those places. There's no point in going to, like, Brooks Camp when the salmon are not running, because there won't be any more bears there than anywhere else.
Right. Well, it's the natural history interpretation is you go where the food happens to be at mm-hmm. that time. And so early in the spring, the bears are on the sedge flats eating the grasses, and that's where they can be seen. And then when the fish arrive, you can go to the streams.
Yeah. And Kodiak is, not many people from Anchorage go to Kodiak, but Kodiak is an incredibly beautiful place to go. And the viewing opportunities there, if you're prepared to pay for a flight, are extraordinary and not so crowded, I think, as some of the ones that are flown from Anchorage.
Yeah, I think that's one of the places we'll probably see that industry potentially grow. And yeah, it's a spectacular place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the few minutes we have left, I want to get a little bit into the sort of conservation issues. Are you seeing climate change impacts to brown bear in terms of denning seasons or anything else?
I don't know if I would directly attribute it to change to global climate change or not. I mean, it does seem, particularly say in the Kenai Peninsula, the bears are going in a little bit later and coming out a little bit earlier. But again, there's so much variation year to year in terms of what can happen. I mean, look at our winter last year compared to two winters ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether that actually is going to be some long-term effect that the bears feel or not, I wouldn't be comfortable saying.
Yeah, and the numbers are still good in our region in terms of how many bear there are and how healthy they are and all that.
Yeah, you know the densities vary a lot across, you know, across Alaska. Productivity differs a lot across Alaska. I don't think there's any particular place where we have what we would consider a conservation concern for brown bears. I mean, we're really fortunate in that, you know, for the most part, our ecosystems are intact and all the species are there. I think the thing, you know, we'll be looking at with, you know, with just this variability in climate and weather through time is, you know, particularly in the wintertime, warm and wet is probably not a good thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Cold and, you know, consistent snow is probably a good thing for them. So we'll see. But it's always a challenge to link some level of impact to population health or productivity. It's always a big leap to make. Mm-hmm. Because there's such subtle changes. But it's something I think we'll collectively keep our eye on through time. And the other part, it's not just that direct effect. It's the indirect effect of, you know, changing in vegetation community structure, changing in where their prey items occur, changes in ocean chemistry that can affect foods that they feed on. I mean, they're, especially on the coast, they are so linked to the marine environment through the intertidal and through the returning salmon. You know, we talk about them as a species, but they're really just part of a bigger system. And so, you know, big picture, we're trying to figure out how that entire system works. But any perturbation to the system can ultimately affect bears.
Yeah, yeah. Great place to stop. An interesting, really interesting topic. I want to thank both of my guests, Grant Hildebrand, who was just speaking. He's the regional wildlife biologist for the National Park Service. Thanks for being with us, Grant.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
And Sean Farley, who's a wildlife physiologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Great. Thanks.
And stick with us. In the next segment here, we're going to give you some travel information and how you can go down to Katmai Park and see some bears down there. So stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to one of our favorite outdoor explorers here on KSKA Anchorage. It has been edited to be replayed here today.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. And now for this final segment on coastal brown bears, Roy Wood is with me, who is the chief of interpretation at Katmai National Park and the camp manager out at Brooks Camp, which is sort of the ground zero for amazing bear viewing. Thanks so much for being with us, Roy.
Thank you.
So we just wanted to quickly let listeners know how to get to Katmai National Park and see the bears. And it takes a couple of steps, right? You need to fly out to King Salmon and then get a smaller plane out to Brooks Camp. And you need to know the seasons and you need to sort of be ready for the conditions out there. What's some of the basic advice you give to Anchorage residents who might want to come to Brooks Camp and see the bears?
Well, it depends on what kind of bear behavior you're interested in seeing. July is the iconic month, if you will. That's the time of the year where the salmon run is just arriving at Brooks Camp. And the salmon are jumping Brooks Falls, and that's where most of the bear activity is. And if you come at that time, that will be the time where you get to see that iconic image of the salmon, you know, leaping fully into the air and being snagged midair by a bear standing on the lip of the falls. If you come at that time of the year, you need to be prepared for kind of the summer Alaska experience, larger crowds. It can be, you know, warm Alaska standards, maybe even hot, you know, 75, sunny. It could be rainy, but basically summertime preparations need to be made.
And I guess it's possible to come down. You could come down at that time just sort of for a day, but that's a really quick turnaround for quite a bit of money. But you can camp out there, right? If at Brooks Camp.
You can, and you're right. It's a long trip to make in one day, and it leads for a lot of stress as people are worried about getting there, seeing bears, and getting back on the plane to catch their flight back to Anchorage or Homer or wherever they're coming from. But there is a lodge there, and you can make reservations in the lodge up to about a year and a half in advance, and you definitely need to make reservations. There's also a Park Service-run campground, and you also need to make reservations for that. And the reservations for our campground go on sale every year on January 5th at 8 a.m. Alaska time. And by about 8:15 a.m. Alaska time, July is full. So you'll want to make sure that you set an alarm and don't miss that and understand how the website works. But it's very doable to fly in, get a campsite, and relatively cheaply, you can stay in our campground.
And we'll have those links on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just look at today's show on brown bear viewing, and you'll find links to figure that out, how you're going to get out to Katmai and get a campsite. So there's other times of year as well, not just July, lower times when it might be easier, less crowded, but you still see bears, right?
Correct. And like right now is a great time to go to Brooks Camp. September is a great time to go there because many of the bears that we see in July that are running around frantically trying to catch fish now have caught a lot of fish. They've meandered back to the Brooks Camp area and they are collecting the dead and dying fish, you know, because the salmon will spawn and die shortly afterwards. And so we will sometimes have more bears in September than we do in July. And they'll be fat, they'll be slow-moving, and have their beautiful winter coats on. And the fall colors can be gorgeous, too. So it's a really neat time to go, and you avoid a lot of the crowds.
And when is the very end? We are pre-recording. When is the very end of the sort of season when you would say, well, after this point, probably there's not going to be too many bears?
Well, the lodge closes on September 18th. The campground stays open, and it gets very, very difficult to get to and from Brooks Camp at that point. You would have to charter a plane. However, the bears will be there well into the middle of October and even beyond, and that's what makes the bear cam such a great experience, too, that you can watch the bears on those cams after it's become virtually impossible to get to Brooks Camp.
I see. So if you're prepared to charter, you could really have it to yourself, but then that gets more complicated and more expensive.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Okay. And then, of course, the East Coast of Katmai is always available by air from Kodiak or Homer or even Anchorage to see bears out on the sort of the intertidal area when they're not chasing the salmon.
Right.
Yeah.
And the locations vary throughout the summer. You know, early on, it's Switchak and Hallow Bay that are really good. Middle of the summer, it's Hallow Bay. End of the season, it's going to be Hallow Bay and Amalek, but also a couple of other interior locations that many of the bear watching guides will take people to, such as Crosswind Lake or Moraine Creek or Funnel Creek. And those are in Katmai National Preserve, very close to McNeil River. And that's a different kind of experience. You know, you'll show up in your small plane with your guide. There'll be, you know, four or five, maybe 10 of you, and you'll go out, you'll stand on the ground with the bears and all the activity goes on around you. Very neat experience, not for everyone, because it can be a little spooky sometimes being on the ground staring eye to eye to a large brown bear's face. But it's a wonderful experience, and it is another way of experiencing the bears of Katmai or you know, even Lake Clark and some of the other locations along the Cook Inlet and Shelikof Strait.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Roy Wood, Chief of Interpretation at Katmai National Park, and he's out at Brooks Camp. And I also want to thank our earlier guest, Laura Jorgensen, was with us in the first section talking about her experience at McNeil River. And then we also heard from Grant Hildebrand, Regional Wildlife Biologist for the National Park Service, and Sean Farley, who's a wildlife physiologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Monica Goki is our producer. Grace Bojean is our production assistant who helps line up guests. I'm Charles Wolfworth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.